Well, good morning. This is Barry O'Dell with the Church of Christ at Mammoth Spring Facebook page. It's Monday morning, October 23rd, 2023. Hope everybody's doing all right today. Hey, Brian, good to see you. Ready to get back into our study. We're going through the Minor Prophets. This is our 28th video on the Minor Prophets, and we are in Zechariah chapter 6 today. For those of you who have been following, you know that. Zechariah chapter 6, an extremely important chapter, so we're just going to cover one today. Let some folks join on here before we really get started. Of course, we're cross-posted onto the nearchurches.com Facebook page, as always. If you have any questions or comments on either one of those pages, use the comment section, and I will acknowledge them when I see them. Good morning, Lyle. Good to see you. All right, let's get started. There's Anna. Good to see you. Zechariah is a book of visions, 8 visions specifically. And the first part of chapter 6 that we're going to talk about today is actually the 8th and final vision. And then the remainder of the book is rather prophetic. We are in 520 BC. The temple is being rebuilt under the leadership of Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, and Joshua, the high priest. Haggai and Zechariah are the contemporary prophets. So that's what we've been looking at. So let's look at this final vision real quick. This is Zechariah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. He sees Zechariah is presented with 4 chariots coming from between 2 mountains, mountains of bronze, the New King James says. So powerful, strong. And many times in the prophets, when you read of mountains, you're not reading of literal, you know, geography. You're reading rather of some form of government, some form of power, something along those lines. But he sees these chariots, 4 of them, and each chariot has multiple horses, and they are each, there's red, black, white, and dappled. So you have a variety of horses with each, and then you have a variety of horses and 4 chariots. And they're strong, according to verse 3. Well, he wants to know, and this is similar with the rest of Zechariah's visions. Well, what are these? In other words, what do these represent? Because remember, as we've been saying through this particular study, let the text tell you what the visions mean. Let the text interpret the signs. Let the text interpret what the symbols mean. So what do they mean? Verse 4. Verse 5, the angel answered and said to me, "These are the 4 spirits of heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth." And then he tells us where they go. The chariot with the black horses and the white horses go to the north country. Again, we have to allow the biblical context, but I would also say the historical context to determine what that means. Okay, so for Judah and Jerusalem, what would the north country represent in this particular setting? Well, that would represent Babylon. Now, what do the question then is, well, what do these chariots and what do the horses represent? And this is similar. John saw this similar type of thing in the Revelation. And these colors typically have some sort of meaning, like black represents pestilence. Red typically represents bloodshed in war. White means victory. You think, for example, in the book of Revelation, Jesus is riding on a white horse. And then the dappled horses typically represent something along the lines of pestilence, famine, you know, some type of suffering. So it's good to know that kind of stuff. But again, don't read too much into the symbols. And what I mean by that is, as I've been saying throughout this series on Zechariah, is so many people come to texts like this and they try to figure out what it means today. Well, it means today what it meant 2,500 years ago. There's no new meaning. There's no new fulfillment that's coming from this today or any time in the future. It's for Zechariah. It's for Joshua, the high priest, for Zerubbabel, the prophet. Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah. They understood what it meant. And the text does reveal some things to us. Well, these horses and chariots, as we're reading through the text here, notice what it says in verse 7. The strong steeds went out, eager to go, that they might walk to and fro throughout the earth. Well, to and fro throughout the earth. We're familiar with that language. The book of Job. Satan is pictured as one who is walking to and fro throughout the earth. Well, these horses and these chariots are from God, and they're the spirits of the heavens. And so this, I believe this represents the angelic host doing God's bidding in the world, whatever that looks like. And we've talked about that a bit because there are so many angels and visions mentioned here as there is in other books like Revelation and Ezekiel. These are God's ministers who are sent out to do His will. The Psalms talk about that extensively. Hebrews chapters 1 and 2 talk about, and in particular, mostly Hebrews chapter 1, that angels are God's ministers sent out to do His will. That's what we're told. What does that look like? How do they do that? We're not given all of those answers. But this is what's going on here. These horses and chariots represent that, walking to and fro throughout the earth. Again, verse 7, and they're going to different parts of the world. Like we've already noticed, the black and the white horses go toward the north country. Well, that would represent Babylon. That makes sense in the historical context. Well, the other horses go to the south country. Well, what exactly does that mean? We're not really told here. Hey, good morning, Linda. Good to see you. Again, I'm not going to try to read things into the text that are not there. We're not exactly told. It's pretty easy to understand what the north country means in this historical setting. Hey, Sheila, good to see you. So, whatever the case may be, whatever the particular meaning is, these are representative of God's angelic beings who are doing His bidding in the world. Now, you notice they walk to and fro throughout the earth, verse 7 says. Verse 8 says, and He called to me and spoke to me, saying, see, those who have gone toward the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country. God's justice against Babylon has been satisfied. And we've talked about this. So God prophesied in a variety of ways to a variety of prophets throughout the years. And He told Israel that they were going to be taken captive, and that they were going to be taken captive by the Babylonians. But we also know, and Zechariah 1 actually points this out for us, Zechariah 1 verses 15 and 16, that God was, in Zechariah's day, exceedingly angry with the nations at ease, for I was a little angry, and they helped, but with evil intent. So these other nations, Babylon for instance, whom God used as an instrument of His wrath against the sin of His own people, well, they went too far in how they treated God's people. And so now God is, let's say, satisfying His wrath against those people. Babylonians took Judah and Jerusalem. Well, the Persians come on the scene, and then they defeat the Babylonians, and they take over. This is all being revealed to Zechariah, and as he says here at the end of chapter 6 and verse 8, these events, okay, these historical events, he says, have given rest to my spirit in the north country. God's wrath, in a sense, is satisfied with what's happened in the developing of what we would call world history, not just with His people, not just with the Jewish nation, but with those nations that surround them and had taken them captive and taken advantage of them. God's wrath is being satisfied on them as well. That's what verses 1 through 8 is. Again, it's so many people fall into the trap of looking for something. It's like they have the, well, what does this mean to me? And they look too much. A lot of times these discussions get political about today. Well, what do these things represent in the world today? My answer to that question would be nothing. They don't represent anything in the world today. These are significant events for God's people 2,500 years ago. And we have to allow the Bible to, I guess you might say, we have to allow the Bible to speak for itself, to interpret itself, instead of reading into the text what we would like it to say. And the rest of chapter 6, which we're going to spend the rest of the video on, is extremely important, and I think helps us deal with a lot of issues that come up in, particularly in religion, and different views that people have about Jesus and Him being king and priest and things like that. So the eighth vision is really just a vision of, to me, it's kind of reassurance to Zechariah. God's wrath against the northern country, Babylon, has been satisfied. And the end of verse 8 tells us that. It's given rest to my spirit in the north country. So that, again, that's the end of the visions in Zechariah. Now we get to chapter 6 and verse 9 here. It says, "Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, receive the gift from the captives, from Heldai, Tobijah, and Jediah, who have come from Babylon, and go the same day and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah." The return from Babylon, so they were there for 70 years. We know that. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah discuss at length the return and the processes that they went through once they got back to their homeland. But the return, Cyrus, king of Persia, allowing them to come back, it didn't all happen in one instant movement. It took time. Ezra and Nehemiah, you read those books, you learn a great deal of information in there about that. So it's like different groups would come back a little bit at a time. You read Ezra chapter 2 and you read about a little over somewhere between 49 and 50,000 people returned during that period of time. But Ezra didn't come back until a little bit later. So anyway, some people have just come back from Babylon. And this is, if we're looking at 520 BC, this is 16 years later than when that initial return happened. So again, they're coming back over time. Well, the gifts. What are the gifts? Verse 11, take the silver and gold. So, and I've pointed that out, Cyrus and the Persians financed the return to Jerusalem for the Jews, financed the reconstruction of the city and the temple, and so they're having what you would call gifts. Verse 10, receive the gift. Verse 11, take the silver and gold, make an elaborate crown, and set it on the head of Joshua the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Then speak to him, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts. So there, this is not a vision. This is an event that's actually going to take place, the making of this crown, the speaking to Joshua the high priest, but it's going to represent something. This is prophetic. And I don't know if there's a way that you can rank which prophecy is more important than the other, and that may be a bad way to phrase it. I don't know that that's right at all, but if there were a ranking system of prophecies about Christ, this one's extremely important. This would be right up there at the top. And you'll see why as we read this. So you're going to address Joshua the high priest. Here's what you say to him once you put this crown on his head. Behold, the man whose name is the branch. Now this is the second time that Zechariah has talked about this individual referred to as the branch. He does it back in chapter 3 and verse 8. And this message was to the high priest as well. Hear, O Joshua the high priest, you and your companions who sit before you, for they are a wondrous sign. Well, what we're reading here in chapter 6 is a sign too. But anyway, he goes on to say, for behold, I am bringing forth my servant, the branch. Well, that's a reference to Jesus. We looked at that in a previous video. Well, that's who this is talking about here too. So there are several passages that, and we'll just do this quickly, several passages that talk about this person who is referred to as the branch, who would come forth from a specific familial lineage, and it's, well, this, Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. There shall come forth a rod, that word means a shoot or a sprout, something along those lines, from the stem of Jesse, a descendant of Jesse. And a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And as you continue reading Isaiah chapter 11, you realize that that is a reference, that that can only be a reference to Jesus. You turn over then to Isaiah. So that was Isaiah 11. You turn over then to Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 2. It says, for he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of a dry ground. So this language of a shoot or a sprout or something coming to life out of the dry ground is representative of what the Jewish people were going through. The nation was cut down, but there's a stump that's left. You know, the prophets, and we've talked about this, the remnant, the small group of those who remained, who maintained their fidelity to God. It's from that remnant that the Messiah would come. And he's referred to as a branch. So Isaiah 53:2 goes on to talk about that. And we know specifically, as you read all of Isaiah chapter 53, that that's talking about Jesus. Isaiah 11, Isaiah 53. Jeremiah has a prophecy about it. Jeremiah, I think it's Jeremiah chapter 33, talks about this branch. And Zechariah does it twice. So back to Zechariah chapter 6 and verse 12. Behold, the man whose name is the branch. From his place he shall branch out, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. Now that's significant because when this prophecy is given, they're already building the temple of the Lord. And it doesn't take them long at all to complete it. I can't remember the specific amount of time, but Ezra and Nehemiah tell us that's a very short period of time before they finish the temple. Well, this is a prophecy of this individual who's coming, who will build the temple of the Lord. But listen to this. He shall build the temple of the Lord. Verse 13. He shall bear the glory. The Gospel of John does this quite often. I don't know how many times exactly, but Jesus refers to the glory that he had with the Father before the world was, and that glory being restored to him. And that glory was restored to him after his resurrection and ascension when he was seated on his throne at the right hand of God. So this branch who is going to come forth is going to build the temple, and he's going to bear the glory. That can only refer to what Jesus is going to do. And listen to this in verse 13, and he shall sit and rule upon his throne. So there's his kingship. All right, there's the kingdom. But then listen to this. So he shall be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. So if we're just reading this out of, well, first time you've ever read it, whoever this is referring to is going to be a priest and a king simultaneously. You turn to the pages of the New Testament, and we're going to look at a few verses here in just a minute, and you read Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus and his lineage, Matthew chapter 1. You read Luke's account of Jesus' birth and lineage as recorded in Luke chapter 3. And you read the book of Hebrews, which we'll look at here in just a minute, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. You put all these pieces of this puzzle together, and we know who Zechariah 6 is talking about, this branch. This one who's going to come forth, this one who's going to build the temple, bear the glory, be a king, and be a priest while he is king. It can only be referring to Jesus. So, I tell you what, let's do this. Let's look at verses 14 and 15, and then we'll come back and look at some implications of verses 12 and 13. So, make this crown, put it on Joshua's head, and tell Joshua this. Verses 12 and 13. Verse 14, now the elaborate crown shall be for a memorial in the temple. So when this prophecy is given to Joshua, he's wearing the crown, but then they're supposed to take the crown off his head and put it in the temple that they are rebuilding in that day, and it's going to serve as a memorial. So put it in the temple of the Lord for Helam, Tobijah, Jediah, and Hen, the son of Zephaniah. Even those from afar shall come and build the temple of the Lord. Now, That helps us even further understand that we're talking about the church here, about the kingdom under Christ, because if you remember in Ezra chapter 4, when the Jews were rebuilding the temple, that the people of the land, the Samaritans, wanted to come and help them. And the response was, no, you have no part in this. You're not going to help us. Well, that's when the persecution started, and they stopped building the temple for 16 years. But then they got back to it under the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah and the leadership of Joshua the high priest and Zerubbabel the governor. And they accomplished that work. But whatever temple this is talking about, which is the church, the kingdom of Christ on earth, even those from afar shall come and build the temple of the Lord. Well, that's a reference to the Gentiles. Well, how do you know that? Because of Ephesians chapter 2. Paul writing to the Ephesians, and they are Gentiles in the flesh. And he tells them that you who were once far off have now been brought near by the blood of Christ. So this shows the construction of the temple, spiritual temple, under Jesus, and that those from afar, the Gentiles, would be a part of the construction, the building of the temple. I'm a Gentile. I'm not from a Jewish background, and I'm part of the kingdom of Christ today. And so that's what this is talking about here. Then you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you, and this shall come to pass if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God. These prophecies are going to be fulfilled. So here's what I want to do. I want to go back to Zechariah 6, verses 12 and 13, and look at some implications. All right, so we know what the text says specifically. The branch, he'll bear the glory, he'll sit on the throne, and he'll be a priest while he's on the throne. But what does that imply? All right, so not yesterday, but the previous Sunday, I preached a sermon here at Mammoth Spring on the, I won't say exactly on premillennialism, but it was dealing with signs of the times. All right, the war in the Middle East, what's going on between Israel and Palestine. People are looking forward to Jesus coming back to earth. There are major problems with that belief system. And there are a couple right here in Zechariah chapter 6. Implication number one from Zechariah chapter 6. If Jesus were literally to return to earth, he couldn't be a king. He couldn't prosper as a king. He's the lineage of David. He's the lineage of Coniah. You read Jeremiah chapter 22, and no man of Coniah's descendants will sit and rule on the throne of David and prosper anymore in Jerusalem. It's not going to happen. But so many people that we know in the denominational world are looking just for that event. They're looking for the rapture. They're looking for the 1,000-year reign. They're looking for the Battle of Armageddon. They're looking for Jesus to come back and rule in Jerusalem. If he ever comes back to earth, he cannot be king. And that's not me saying that. That's not me making that up. That's in accord with the prophecy given to us in Jeremiah chapter 22 about the king by the name of Coniah, who is king of Judah towards the end, right? You know, when during the time when Babylon's coming up against the Israelite nation and taking them into 70 years of captivity. So that's implication number one. He will sit and rule upon his throne. Jesus is going to be king. Well, are there any passages in the New Testament that tell us that Jesus was king in the first century? Let's say it that way. Yeah, there are several passages. I'm going to turn over. One of the first ones is Acts 2. I'm not going to look at that one right now, but Acts 2 verses 29 to 32 deals with that. The one I'm going to is in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, which is the resurrection chapter. But that chapter talks about the reign of Christ as well. And Paul's writing in the mid-first century talking about the reign of Jesus. And he wasn't on earth. He was in heaven. All right, so 1 Corinthians 15:20. But now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection from the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. But each one in his own order, Christ the first fruits. Afterwards, those who are Christ's, listen to this. Afterwards, those who are Christ's at his coming. So Christ is going to return, yes. Verse 24. Then comes the end. We have to answer the question, when does the end come? Well, that's verse 23. At his coming. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, when he puts an end to rule, to all rule and all authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet, and the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. So this is Paul talking in the mid-first century, and he says when Jesus comes, that's the end. That's not the... When Jesus comes is not a 1,000-year reign. When Jesus comes is not the Battle of Armageddon. It's not the rapture. When he comes, it's the end, and he's going to reign until that point in time, which... Well, the implication of that is, as Paul's writing to the Corinthians, Jesus was reigning right then. He's going to reign until he has put all enemies under his feet, and that last enemy is death. You and I are still subject to death. We have not conquered death yet. Now, Jesus has. We know that. But we conquer death in the resurrection. That's why he, Jesus, is called the first fruits. Our resurrection is going to be just like his, personal, bodily, but it's not going to happen until he comes. It's going to happen at the end, and he's going to reign until that happens. Jesus is not going to start reigning when he gets back. So when you're looking at Zechariah chapter 6, it says He'll build the temple of the Lord. He will bear the glory and shall sit and rule on his throne. But not only that, so that's happening now. Not only that, it also says this, so he shall be a priest on his throne. All right, well, biblical priesthood, what is it? How does one qualify? I don't know if that's the best word, but how does one qualify to be a priest on earth? You have to be of the tribe of Judah. Nope, I just said that wrong. You have to be of the tribe of Levi. The Levitical tribe was the tribe of the priesthood. But we know that Jesus is not of the Levitical tribe. So if he's on earth, he cannot be priest because he's from the wrong tribe. So I'm turning over to Hebrews chapter... I'll do chapter 7 and chapter 8. Listen to this. Hebrews chapter 7. I'll start in verse 11 here. It says, therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priesthood should rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? Aaron, that's where it started, under the Mosaic system. Aaron and his sons were anointed as priests. The tribe of Levi became the priestly tribe. But verse 12 says, Hebrews 7, for the priesthood being changed, of necessity there is also a change of the law. For he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe from which no man has officiated at the altar. Well, what does that mean? Verse 14 tells you what it means. For it is evident that our Lord arose from Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning the priesthood. So Zechariah 6 tells me that whoever's going to build the temple of the Lord is going to bear the glory. He's going to sit and rule on his throne, and while he's on his throne, he's going to be priest. Hebrews, listen, so Hebrews chapter 8, and we'll start in verse 1. Now this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. There's Jesus on his throne. He's king. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected, and not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Again, that's Levitical. Therefore, it is necessary that this one also have something to offer. For if so, listen to this, what Hebrews 8:4 says about Jesus. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law. Well, to be able to offer gifts according to the law, you have to be from Levi. And the Hebrews writer says, if he were on earth, he cannot be a priest. But Zechariah says, he's going to be both a king and a priest simultaneously. If Jesus is coming back to earth, he has to give up being a king and he can no longer serve as priest. There are so many different aspects of the life of Christ that covers in his position, his authority. Premillennialism is the belief that there's going to be a rapture and the battle of Armageddon and Jesus reigning for 1,000 years on earth is completely destroyed with these two verses, Zechariah 6, verses 12 and 13. I had somebody recently ask me, because I did that sermon, I guess it would have been October 15th here at Mammoth. Somebody asked me, and it was a good question, well, does it matter if somebody believes in premillennialism? You know, are they going to endanger their soul if they believe in the 1,000-year reign and the rapture and all of this? And the answer to that question is yes, it absolutely matters. You cannot hold to a false doctrine and be right with God. Because you're not going to keep that doctrine to yourself. You're going to teach other people. And if you're saying that Jesus is going to come back to earth and be king on earth, then you're contradicting multiple scriptures. And by the way, if he were on earth, he couldn't be a priest. So what are you going to do for a priesthood? It's not okay to hold to a false doctrine. You're not going to be okay with that. And like I said, these two verses here completely destroy this idea. And so... and I'll just tell you, I've struggled with this one. There's this belief even among some within the Lord's church that heaven's going to be on earth, that the earth is going to be renovated and Jesus is going to be on earth with us. Well, there again, if that is the case, He's not our priest anymore, and he's not our king anymore. If he's coming back to earth, none of that works. So that's a doctrine that a lot of people paint as harmless. And, you know, you can hold that view that the earth's going to be renovated. But you have to hold that position. There are a lot of things you have to deal with that are just frankly contradictory. I was talking to one guy, a preacher within the Lord's church a while back about this, about the renovated earth and stuff. And I said, well, what do you do about the priesthood of Jesus? If he's coming back to earth, you know, because Hebrews 8 says he can't, if he's on earth, he can't be a priest. I said, well, what do you do with that? We're just having a conversation about it. And he said, his response to that was, well, we won't need a priest then. I was like, okay, well, that's convenient for you to say that. It's not about our need. It's about his role as priest and king. If he's on earth, he can be neither, according to Scripture. But so many people hold to a doctrine that he's coming back and he's going to be a priest and a king on earth. And it is not okay to hold to doctrines that directly contradict Scripture. How do they account for the earth being destroyed with fervent heat? Good question, Sheila. And the guys I have dealt with personally within the Lord's church, they use, I believe it's the English Standard Version. And if I'm not mistaken, the English Standard Version in 2 Peter chapter 3, when it talks about the earth being destroyed and melted with fervent heat and dissolved and all of that, the ESV translates some of those words as, is it purified or burned off? I don't remember exactly, and I don't want to misquote it, but it's based on what version of the Bible they use. There are a lot of linguistic gymnastics that are encountered when you deal with that. It's been a couple of years since I've had those discussions and did the writing that I did on that, but it's basically, they say, well, it's like the flood, because 2 Peter 3 talks about the flood and the earth being destroyed. Well, the earth was still here after the flood, and so it's still going to be here after the judgment. No, that in no way works out with that language of melted, dissolved, fervent heat, burned up. A renovated earth doesn't work out with any of that language. But if you have the right English version, it does. It's interesting how that works. So, I don't know. Zechariah 6, I tell you, like I said earlier, Zechariah 6, 12 and 13, those are two extremely important verses that deal with the role of Jesus as simultaneously serving as priest and king. But then it's not only that, it says, and the council of peace shall be between them both. That is, between his priesthood and his reign. It's going to be a time of harmony. And that's Isaiah chapter 11. You know, Isaiah chapter 11 talks about the wolf laying down with the lamb and the child playing over the hole of a poisonous snake and nobody's going to be harmed. Well, it's a kingdom of peace. Those things aren't literally going to happen on a renovated earth. It's prophetic language that's using human language to describe a scenario that's at peace. And it's like Ephesians, I mentioned it earlier, Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians 2:15 says that he is our peace, who has made both Jew and Gentile one, and has broken down the wall of partition that stood between them. That's what it means that he's going to be a king and a priest, and the council of peace shall be between them both. You have to read a lot into the text to come away with premillennialism. You have to read a lot into the text to come away with a renovated earth belief system. And it's rather ugly to watch the hurdles that have to be jumped to get to those conclusions. And to get to those conclusions, you just have to contradict clear statements of Scripture. Statements that are not difficult to interpret at all. So maybe that's a bit of a long answer there, Sheila, but that's a good question. That's what I've got for today, guys. I think tomorrow, we've got a busy week. We've got some stuff to do with our school on Wednesday, so I'm not gonna go live on Wednesday. We'll come back tomorrow and we'll do chapter 7. We'll see how far we get, maybe into chapter 8 as well. But I appreciate you guys being on here today. Went a little bit over time, but that's all right. Guys, hope you have a good day. Thank you for being here, and hope to see you back here tomorrow at 11 o'clock for Zechariah chapter 7. Have a good day.